showcase. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Millennial 2022. This is with the Course of Empire, but since it relates to Canadian matters, I brought a fellow Canadian friend of mine on as a co-host, and that is Felix of Felix Rex and Black Pigeon Speaks. So welcome to Felix, and welcome to the Course of Empire.
Thanks.
Of course, but would you like to introduce yourself briefly?
Yeah, sure. Well, as you mentioned, I'm Canadian. I live on the west coast of Canada, lived here most of my life. And I'm kind of a older age Gen Xer. I have always pretty much been more on the political right, but generally with a bit more of, I guess you say, an edge. I wasn't fully red-pilled about everything, shall we say, all the time, but I kind of knew about a lot of things, even though I didn't fully get it, which a lot of people, even other conservatives or right wingers, didn't always seem to appreciate. And but 5 years ago, I definitely got a lot more red pilled. And I don't know what else I can say.
I think a lot of people got red pilled about 5 or 6 years ago, partly because of channels on YouTube that were thriving at the time.
Yeah, partly due to you for me, but yeah.
Well, I'm glad to know. Thank you for saying that. Canada, I mean, this was an issue with a previous guest that we were discussing. Canada at one point was a fairly conservative country, and it has morphed in recent decades, but especially over the last 10 years, the tenure of Justin Trudeau. What would you say about Canada, the Canada of your childhoods? Course of Empire, do you want to go for this first and just describe the country that you remember?
Well, to be honest, I've never really saw it as terribly conservative or right wing, even when I was old enough to really notice things, you know, from my early teens when I started getting more politically aware. I've been uneasy about Canada from the get-go. I have never totally felt comfortable with the country. I've thought a lot of its narrative was not really something I connected with. This whole they call it the two solitudes thing in Canada, with the French and the Anglos kind of thing. And I always saw that as kind of a thing for people back east in Ontario and Quebec and, you know, central Canada. That was their fight, and I never really identified that closely with it. And I'm old enough to have a memory of Justin's dad. Of course, many would say he is not his dad, but we'll not go down that route. But Pierre Trudeau,
it's an open secret, isn't it?
And Pierre Trudeau very much ramped up a lot of what moved Canada towards a more progressive society. There were elements of that before then. Yeah, it was definitely more conservative prior to that. In fact, back during the Great Depression, it was in many ways more conservative than the United States. But by the time I was really aware of things, you know, he had already been doing much to transform Canada, push Canada in the direction that it ultimately has led to with Justin. And, there were a lot of things back then. I was thinking we're heading in a direction that I'm not at all happy with. Some of the things I didn't think would go quite as bad as they have gone. They're blowing my mind. And it's not just Canada. Again, a lot of these things are interconnected with the West in general. So it's not really, it's Canada. It's like everywhere.
But Canada does seem to have its own momentum in this regard.
For sure. And it has been one of the most consistently progressive countries for years. And all the kind of people on the left would be very proud of that, of course, you know, and they're so happy to put a Canadian flag on their luggage to go to Europe. You see, they love us. They hate the Americans, but they love us, which I always went, yeah, sure. But, yeah. I never bought into that. That was always a very much a left wing kind of Canadian view of the world, that we're so polite and we're so kind and everybody loves us. And I'm like, no, they don't. They mostly don't even think about us at all.
I think it did have its own mystique, though. I mean, probably in a similar way to Scotland has a mystique compared to England.
I guess.
Felix, would you like to talk about this, chime in on this matter of Canada as a country that had its own standing in the world compared to America?
Well, I would agree with a lot of what he just said, and I apologize to your viewers for gate crashing, but I was told by many people that I should join, and because of my scheduling that I wasn't really able to, but I thought joining this conversation would be beneficial, just because I myself grew up in Canada on the West Coast as well. But I also apologize, my voice is a bit bad today. I've been sick the last few things. But what he said about the thing about Canadians having this, for example, Canadians will always put a Canadian flag on their bag when they travel through Europe because they have this jumped up sense of self-importance about Canada's place in the world. And they have this idea that everyone loves Canada, like it's this somehow rare and special gem, whereas as the United States is some sort of hated lump of coal, is something I can completely identify as what he's saying. And I think, and I get a lot of flack from other Canadians when I say, I think what it is it reminds me of the relationship that Korea has with Japan, or not so much Greece and Turkey, but you know, other
perhaps
countries,
New Zealand and Australia, for
example. So you have this country that is, it has a large cultural and world footprint, and next to it you have kind of this irrelevant cold tundra land that, what is Canadian, and that doesn't go all the way back, but the thing is it's this new Canadian national identity. And the thing is that it's an inferiority complex that masks itself as a superiority complex. And I get a lot of flack for saying that. But Canada, previously to what he was talking about, Justin's father, Pierre, it actually did have its own culture that was Anglo and Francophone. And I understand what he's talking about vis-a-vis what's called Western alienation. And there's this sense in the Western provinces of Canada that they don't really matter, because the populations within Quebec and Ontario, it doesn't matter how anybody west of Ontario votes, because the elections finish at the border of Ontario and Manitoba. And you've got something that's been coined as Western alienation. But previously to this sort of this push from Justin's father, Pierre, I think that there was something that could be called Canadian, and something you could be proud of, in the sense that it was this wilderness that was tamed by rugged individual men. And it was made into, at least economically and materially, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, but also in its natural pristine beauty. It was one of the last, sheer wildernesses in the temperate side of the planet, other than Russia, and tack on Alaska to that. But I don't want to dominate the conversation, but yeah, I just thought I'd chime in on, I'm pretty much agreeing with almost a lot of things that the Course of Empire is saying.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I mean, there was the whole last best West thing, which was Canadians are taught this in school, no one else cares, but it was a policy of the Canadian government at the end of the 19th century. The U.S. West was closed. It was finished. It was, sure, people are still filing into it, but in terms of the open West, the Wild West, it was basically over by, the 1890s. It was really winding down. But in Canada, there was vast terrain still in the West, and so people were flooding it, a lot of them from the U.S. I mean, if you go to places like Alberta and, to an extent, Saskatchewan and British Columbia, where I am, there was a lot of Americans that came up. And part of it was due to things like gold rushes and so forth. But it was also because the government said, there's a ton of land here. If you break it, it's yours. You can be a farmer. You can be a rancher. And so we had loads of people coming from Great Britain, you know, and Ireland back then, of course, is still part of UK. But lots of Americans, you got some Aussies as well, so forth, and a lot of other Europeans. But, you know, it tended to be Anglos who would come to this vast, like you said, pristine territory. And there's still a lot of it. I mean, it so much of Canada is empty. Of course, a lot of it nobody wants to live in because it's tundra. But the southern third, especially the more habitable part of the land, still, you can drive for hours without seeing a soul. There are parts of Canada like that. I mean, which can
you can drive for hours and hours and hours.
Hours and hours. Nobody's there.
I mean,
you can't
overestimate how far you can drive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, the size of this country is immense. It's bigger than the U.S., which is also an immense nation, right? And I've had, you know, my wife and I both had conversations with people in the past, where, especially, you know, usually people from Britain, but it could be Europeans in general, and they don't fully always get the absolute immense size of this country, that you can fit all the U.K. into British Columbia alone more than one time over. That's how big it is, and British Columbia is not even the biggest province in Canada. So that's how big a country this is. So you can literally go on forever, and you know, it just never seems to end. And I mean, there was one case years ago. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but my wife encountered some people that were, I think one was from Scotland, the other was from Ireland, a couple, and they were going to do a quick whirlwind tour of Vancouver Island in one day. And she was with a friend. And they were like, "Oh no! I don't think you understand. Vancouver Island, it's like almost 2/3 the size of England or something like that." So
I'd say it's probably lengthwise it's longer, not maybe widthwise, but lengthwise.
I don't know if it is, but it's definitely a substantial amount of that territory equivalent. So you're not doing a whirlwind tour a Vancouver Island in one day. You're going to have to dedicate days and days of travel. So they said, maybe just go to the South Island, which is the most populated area, Victoria being the biggest city. It's the provincial capital. But, you know, they didn't know. They thought, you know, we'll just pop over on the ferry, do a quick, you know, spend 4 or 5 hours, see the whole island. It's like, no, you're not. It'll take you probably 7 or 8 hours minimum driving at high speed from one end to the other. To be able, and without stopping, you know, and that's all you're going to get to do. So, yeah, the size of this nation is substantial. But we've spent far too much time on that, I think. Well, but anyways,
can either of you tell? Because somebody has said the best description of Canada and these first early explorers is Stan Rogers' song "Northwest Passage," and this is rather embarrassing, but that I know that phrase. Because it was the original title of Twin Peaks, to David Lynch's TV series. It was originally going to be called Northwest Passage because
I didn't know that.
The town of Twin Peaks is right on the border. And indeed, yes. The border crossing is a certain theme in that program about drugs and prostitution and stuff like that. Can either of you explain the term Northwest Passage, what that actually refers to?
Well, that was the elusive Northwest Passage that European explorers were always looking for a quick way around the globe, right? For trade and what have you. And, you know, you had like the Franklin expedition. I don't know if you know that. That was back in the 19th century that came from England, and they all perished, because they went so far north and, you know, just went into just frigid territory. So that was kind of the thing. I think I've heard that song a long time ago. I'm not like a big follower of Stan Rogers. He's kind of, you know, got a strong following over here with a lot of people. He's a folk. He's dead now. I think he died in a plane accident or whatever years back. But he does have kind of a strong following, and guys like him, you know, kind of are supposed to be, you know, bringing together sort of the Canadian, mystique, you know, in terms of the narrative and so forth, which again, yeah, there's a lot of that, you know, I kind of agree with identify, but again, a lot of it's also more central Canada, eastern Canada, but that doesn't mean that what he says is invaluable and definitely contributes to the overall narrative of what Canada is, but yeah, well, I you know
Here's another comment. The music of Stan Rogers makes me want to live in Canada, a rugged, manly place. The opposite of the global consumer living in the greater Toronto, Montreal area.
Or Vancouver. Yes. Well, and that's true. I mean, the old Canadian was that. I mean, if you look at all those old trappers, you know, the fur trappers and what have you, the original frontier people, you know, the pioneers and all that, much like the U.S., right? It's the same idea where you would travel again forever. Nobody's around. Occasionally you would bump into one of the local tribes, which may or may not be a hostile situation. It wasn't as bad in Canada for that as in the U.S. The British and the French also tended to work better with them than they did in the U.S. The U.S., it was much more hostile between the two. So, I don't want to spend too much time on that, obviously, either. It is a complicated issue. But, you know, that you would have these rugged individuals who would, you know, would put on the canoe and march along the land to the next river. And then they'd, you know, row on the river and, you know, back on their back, you know, carrying the canoe again for another 3 or 4 hours into the next, you know, like literally all day. That's all they did, just to travel from point A to B to get to their destination where they can lay out their traps and build some makeshift, living quarters so they could survive through the winter as they eat their, you know, I don't know, hardtack or whatever the heck they ate. I don't know, jerky, but and whatever they could rummage.
It does seem amazing that this idea of men leaving England and leaving Britain and going to this wilderness and gradually taming it. I mean, it's quite an astonishing story just in and of itself, you know.
Oh yeah.
I was just going to say it was a continent. So I mean, you got to ask yourself what happened between those men coming over from Britain and taming a complete continent, a wilderness, to what we have now. Like honestly, the Canada right now, there's not a news story that comes out of that country that doesn't just either. Well, I'm at the point where I just, oh yeah, of course, it's Canada. You know, what anything that comes out of that. Recently, there's been, you're guiding the conversation, Colin, but there's just news that comes out of that country, from the trucker convoy to euthanasia to Trudeau's latest escapades of, you know, blubbering about apologizing to whomever, which group from 200 years ago.
There's the trans stuff most recently and his obsession with gay pride. Yeah. And, you know, I don't, like, it's a cheap shot to say this, but I wouldn't be surprised if he is gay. He's obsessed with the matter. Above and beyond what most world leaders tend to be. And then the other thing is, the euthanasia, there was another matter this year. What the hell was it? I can't remember what it was. It came into my head and it's left now. But either way, he does seem to have been sort of almost left in charge of this as a scion of globalism to transform the country, you know.
Well, he did say early on, like when he was first elected in 2015, that he wanted to turn Canada into the first post-national nation. He wanted, it's not just, we're going postmodern at the national level, you know, it says we're no longer going to be connected. We're going to be totally rootless in the ultimate sense, totally cosmopolitan in every sense. And we're going to be the benchmark for that. We're going to be the vanguard. You know?
No, he also added to that. I made several videos on that because I was just not only horrified, but I wasn't surprised. And he added to that, not only that we're going to be the first post-national country, but there is no culture, there is no dominant society for anyone to integrate into.
Yes.
Which means that literally whatever the country is, it's basically the way I describe it, is that Canada is just an economic zone to grow GDP.
Yeah,
it's just one gigantic economic unit. And unfortunately, we're seeing right now, and let's be honest, we're seeing massive tribalization between the groups that are coming in now into the country, and they're fighting over the corpse of what was built by those that built the country. And there's a very big distinction between the people that are arriving now. The people that built the country were settlers and frontiersmen. The people that are arriving now are immigrants. And there's a very big difference between those two, because these men arrived into a wilderness. And what you have is the prime minister of the country saying that the edifice, the entirety of the nation that was built. And all you have to do is look at the heraldry of Canada. If you look at the heraldry, if you look at a Canadian passport, the heraldry is almost identical to the British, but the shield has the four founding nations. It has the Irish, the French, the English, and the Scots. And recently they said the leaf is the natives. And those are the people that built Canada. Mm. But now we're being told that diversity built Canada, and it's a nation that, it's a free for all. And what you're seeing now is the people that built that country being relegated to the back of the bus, as it were, and being told that, no, you don't have a country. This country is a free for all. And by the way, you have no group identity. And if you express a group identity, we will in any way, shape or form, make sure that we'll destroy your lives.
Only if you're white.
Well, that's what I'm talking
only
about.
Only if you're white, though. Definitely that's, only if
that's
you're
what
white.
I'm talking about.
Yeah, for sure. Although sometimes, yeah, no, it's pretty.
Sorry about that interjection.
No, not a problem. And you're right. I mean, even the whole thing, it not only is it highly revisionist, you know, the whole historical narrative thing that they're doing, even shoehorning the natives, you go, okay, yeah, but they were there all along. True. They were there for thousands of years, whatever. True, but did they really build Canada any more than they built the United States? No, they did not. They did not. If you objectively look at it, were they the ones who came together in, you know, conferences, who debated things, who wrote things, who crafted constitutions? No, they weren't present. I'm not saying that they're not.
No, there wasn't a nation.
There wasn't. They were. British Columbia has 300 tribes. Tell me which one of those nations was, you know, predominant. They weren't. They weren't, of course. They definitely not British Columbia, because they didn't even join Canada until, 1871, so a few years after the country became a nation, independent nation. But there are so many of these tribes, and they didn't even like each other half the time. It's not like they're all one happy family. Another false narrative that gets presented, the monolith of the indigenous people. They're all just together, and it's the mean white people that cause the problems, and that's a lie. But in terms of building a nation, creating a nation, like you said, English, Scots, Irish, French, Scots especially, it was commonly said that the Scots built Canada. More than any, they punched above their weight. They were so dominant. I mean, so many of the prime ministers were Scots. If you look at
the first prime minister, Sir John A. Macdonald,
even our current one, he's three-quarters Scottish. We all look at his French name and go, he's French. But
I hate to say, though, John A. Macdonald has been canceled.
Yeah, I know he's been canceled. But, yeah, Justin Trudeau going with the Pierre is his dad, of course. His dad was half Scottish, and his mom was fully Scottish. Her maiden name is Sinclair. She was from a prominent Scottish family in Vancouver, West Vancouver, technically. But so heavily Scottish, like, you know, had Simon Fraser, you know, another prominent guy. You had another Alexander Mackenzie, all these guys who were prominent explorers in Canada. So Canada was very much built by Europeans, without a doubt, and with a special element from the Scots. The Scots were so dominant. But something went awry in the 1960s, especially as more of this kind of post-World War II kind of mentality was creeping in to greater and greater extent, even in the 1950s to an extent. And now we're seeing the fruit of that. And I mean, it's the fruit that we're seeing in so many countries, but Canada definitely seems to be pretty close to the worst. I don't know. Australia is running up there pretty high too. And
Sweden's chasing to the bottom with us.
I know. It's like, which one gets to be the leader of being the losers? I don't know.
One thing I'll say about the Scots is they punched a bunch of their weight in the colonial endeavors in South Asia as well.
Hong Kong and so
yeah. Like yeah, I mean, yeah, it's true. I mean, they're all around South America. I got to ask you a question, Colin. Have you changed your ways these days? I mean, it's a bit of a weird one, but you know, we've talked about your, you know, you're the thing that you like. You know that thing you like.
Oh, all right, yeah. Oh, I try not to drink too much of it. No.
Oh, I am okay.
I still am partial to it, if that's what you mean. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, guys, this is your stream, so I'm going to check out now, and I wish you both well. I mean, and Colin, try to stop drinking that stuff so much, because we've had this conversation a few times. So, you guys take care, and I wish you well, and have a great stream.
Okay, thank you very much. It's nice for you to make an appearance on Millennial.
All right,
bye guys.
Okay,
bye.
All right. Okay, so that was a wee thing there that I thought would be quite pleasant for Felix to appear on Millennial, because he's been traveling a lot, so he couldn't make an actual appointment on it this year, but still, it was nice to have him on. I mean, on the matter of the Scots and Canada, you can actually hear it in the accent, and this is one of the things that distinguishes it from the American accent. You can hear that difference, and I don't know if that's a historical thing, if it is consistent. But and as for Justin Trudeau being three quarters Scottish, that surprises me. But you know, that lends credence to the theory that his parentage is not quite what it's
actually Castro. And his height too, because his dad was much shorter than him, whereas Fidel Castro was quite tall. But the timeline doesn't totally match up, which is part of my concern with that whole narrative that his mother didn't meet Fidel till a few years after he was born. But there's others who say that they secretly somehow got together. I have no idea. That seems kind of sketchy, but whatever. I don't really care.
There's a photo of them where Justin Trudeau is a baby.
Yes, so, that's after.
It couldn't be that long after. So, I mean, they're in Cuba or whatever. I'm guessing it was Cuba, and Fidel's there holding the baby. I mean,
I remember correctly, Trudeau was born in 72, and I believe they first met Castro in 74. So you've been like 2 years old. So unless there was some secret rendezvous where she was spirited down to Havana or he up to Ottawa where they could have a tryst. I don't know how it would work, but I mean, it's funny if nothing else.
Either way, I think it did work, because if you look at the guy, he doesn't look anything like Pierre Trudeau.
No, he doesn't. He's like 6'4", and his dad was like 5'8". And in so many ways physically, but maybe it was the Sinclair side, his mother's side, where he got the physical characteristics. I have no idea.
Well, possibly. I mean, it's the kind of thing that they would obviously cover up. And I don't, on the one hand, I wish it, I didn't care so much, because I wish I could just say, well, it's their private lives, whatever, who cares? It doesn't affect anything. In the case of Justin Trudeau, it does seem relevant, because the guy does seem to have a certain identity crisis. He doesn't seem, I mean, even the way he talks about his own country as the post-national, post-national country, state. And the way he's obsessive about diversity, it implies someone who's really not comfortable with with who he is or who he thinks he is. But you know, that's COD psychology, I guess. Not sure.
I think in his mind he is comfortable, but he is kind of that progressive mentality where he, you know, he just doesn't see how ridiculous and how lacking in coherence his view really is. But he thinks he does have it. I sincerely think he probably does. But it doesn't really, like, objectively, when you listen to him and stuff, you go, what is this guy talking about? I mean, half the time he sounds like a moron anyways. But,
how popular is he with just ordinary people in your experience, in your sort of orbit?
He's surprisingly popular, and even around where I am, there's still not to the level he was in 2015, but there's certain pockets, and it's kind of like what Felix was saying. it doesn't matter what the West does, because if Ontario and Quebec vote for his party, the Liberal Party of Canada, you know, in at large scale, vote for him, it doesn't matter what we do. It really doesn't matter, because he'll get at least a minority government.
Thank you very much.
Who is that mysterious person giving you some coke?
thank you very much, a mysterious visitor.
Who is that person? Who could that? What? Wait a second.
Here we go. The camera's the top one there. There we go. Yeah, they're reacting to that. There's a nice wee stunt here that we thought we'd arrange.
Yes.
Where Felix materializes in my actual filming studio.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's what we were doing.
I'm surprised you were able to get past the security.
The security was bad. Yeah, I had to push past a whole gallon of Coca-Cola. But I was able to bring it.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. I actually am quite parched, so that was just very timely.
It's exactly what you needed.
Yes. So thank you very much.
Yeah. So what I'd like to say is thanks, everybody, for having me on Millennial U. I'm sorry I wasn't able to do my own thing, but I am traveling a lot right now. And I'll be on it next year. But this is the best I could do. And I don't want to, you know, bomb the thing anymore. But thanks, everybody, for being here, okay?
All right.
All right.
Well, thanks very much.
I'll see you again soon.
Okay. See you later. See you. All right. Nice wee interlude.
Yes.
All right. So that was just my friend. He happens to be staying over just now, so we thought we'd do it with this stream, since it is Canada-centric already. So, all right. With that done... So let's get to it. I mean, we were discussing Canada, Trudeau, his identity. Mm. Well, I mean, and, you know, there are other world leaders who are similarly obsessed with diversity.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily something that's specific to him. The reason, the thing that I think is unique about him, or at least unusual, is that he seems to genuinely believe it. Whereas I could believe that Jacinda Ardern, for example, she just knows it's the fashionable thing to say. You know, she's sort of head girl prefect thing, so she's just doing what she has to do. But with Justin Trudeau, I think he'd be lost without this. I can't imagine him functioning in, this, let's say, the 1950s or the 1900s. Oh, no. That would be the distinction there.
So, oh, he would not have survived that era. He would have been cast out. He would have been shunned by everybody, even people who. Even people who lean more to the left in those days would have kicked them out. I mean, they were. That's how far we've gone. yeah, he was. He's something else. And the question of his sexuality is definitely something that is often brought up. There have been accounts, even by quite legitimate sources, that suggest he's definitely bisexual. I have some inside knowledge, but. As well, but I mean, it's not something they're going to blab about, and you know, it's neither here nor there really at the end of the day, other than the fact that it kind of you know, goes again to his kind of character, you know, the rumors of orgies and stuff that him and his wife and things like that, all that's kind of out there.
I mean, we don't need to go into that stuff because his public policies and his public behavior is outrageous enough, you know,
it aligns.
Yeah. As for being gay, all I would say about that, I mean, I honestly don't care about this kind of thing. But when he came over to Britain for the Queen's funeral, he was filmed in some hotel, some swanky hotel, singing Bohemian Rhapsody.
I know.
while some guy played the piano. And it's absolutely, I mean, you know, if you wanted to scare a wife, you would send her a video of her husband doing that, and without even captioning it, and I think you could get, you know, you could cause a lot of drama doing that.
I mean, that's just par for the course for him, though. It really is. It's like he's just oblivious. He's just so self-absorbed.
I've remembered the other issue that popped into my head earlier, and it then disappeared. It was the residential schools thing.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Ah, it's, see, a lot of people outside of Canada do not know anything about that. It's kind of our slavery narrative, our Holocaust narrative, whatever you want to call it. You know, they had to find something, right? Because slavery was never really an issue in Canada. Very minimal amounts in the early days, in the colonial days, but it was pretty much avoided and quickly repudiated. There was a fellow named, what's his name? John Graves Simcoe. He was the governor or lieutenant governor of what became eventually Ontario. And he actually, in the 1790s, I think it was, he abolished slavery outright. So that was kind of setting the tone. And then, of course, being under British rule, you know, even though, you know, they were colonies, obviously, they had their own local rule, but still ultimately by the crown, it was 1833 that slavery was completely abolished empire-wide. So that included Canada. It wasn't like the Americans to the south of us. The Americans carried on. And, of course, you know, there's the whole issue of their war, their civil war, war between states, which I think has been way overplayed in terms of its connection to slavery, for sure. But we won't go down that path right now. But in Canada, it wasn't really much of a thing to begin with. It became less of a thing with Simcoe, and it completely ended by the 1830s. There's, you know, they really had to try it. Like, there was a thing recently, but they really tried to drum up, oh, we found like 3,000 slaves existed in Canada at one point. It's like, 3,000? Yeah. That's it?
I think this is why they've had to use the residential
school. They had to find the residential school.
Yeah.
Because it's the native population, the indigenous population. And so what they happened, for those who don't know, it mostly began to happen in the late 1800s, is that the Canadian government said, look it, we're becoming increasingly industrialized. We are in control now. You natives, like it or not, that's the way it is. You're under our control here. Sure, you got your land with the reserves. We call them reserves, by the way, not reservations. That's a distinction between us and the U.S. Same thing, really. And we want you to become more assimilated, acculturated into our general society. So we're going to take your kids and we're going to stick them in schools. And whether you like it or not, we're going to take your kids, by the way. And we're going to stick them in schools and we're going to teach them English or French if they're in Quebec. We're going to teach them basic life skills. There wasn't a whole lot in the early days as much on reading and writing, but that did come more and more later. It was more of how can you be a functional factory worker, basically, and survive in an industrial society and live with a white man. And that's the way it is. Now, it's really mixed. Like, there were definitely abuse, you know, the whole taking kids from their parents, that's pretty bad. But a lot of times the parents were willingly giving their kids, and they wanted their kids to be trained because we want our kids to survive in the white man's world. And there's also the whole abuse, you know, sexual and physical abuse. Yeah, there were some schools where that was bad. There's a lot of schools where it never happened. I knew a woman who went through one of those schools, and she was like, we had a great time. We got along with all the teachers and everything. Nobody was abused. Don't know what you're talking about. Because keep in mind, the residential schools continued. The last of them didn't close till 1996. So that's quite recent. They weren't as common in the latter stages of the 20th century, but they were still around. But the narrative that has come out of it, especially when we had our Truth and Reconciliation, you know, following South Africa's lead in that respect, which is ominous as soon as you hear that. The narrative is, it's 100% evil. Evil white man. Why is the evil white man always doing evil all the time? He's once again doing it to our poor, downtrodden native folk who are all uniformly good and do nothing but good all the time and love each other and they love nature. But you come along and you destroy them. Why do you do that, white man? Why? You know, that's pretty much the narrative. And it's very tiresome.
It's cartoonish, but people believe
it. Oh, it is.
And it is. It's one of those things that you believe in without realizing that it's cartoonish. And then eventually you don't believe in it for whatever reason. And then you think, how did I ever believe something so ridiculous, so cartoonish?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And the funny thing is, until relatively recently, you still had newspaper articles that would indicate how nuanced it really was, that it was more mixed. You would get things where they would interview people who went through these schools, and they said they either had really quite positive or It was kind of a mix. Yeah, I got some positive things out of it. Learned how to read and write, certain life skills. There's one guy who became a pretty significant pianist who learned how to play piano while he's at one of these schools. And he said, I'm really thankful that I learned all this stuff. But he said, but yeah, there were some issues I didn't like about it. There was some mistreatment. So it was kind of a mix, but it was nuanced. It wasn't like 100% black and white, which is how it's presented to everybody, right?
Well,
and that is how racism and everything else, slavery, I mean, and everything else is presented.
Yeah, obviously it's presented as 100% bad because of the fundamental intention. Inherent in the whole thing, which was to, I don't want to mischaracterize it, but the very idea of taking these people from their culture, these kids from their culture, and westernizing them. Mm. I mean, we can't even bring ourselves to encourage immigrants arriving today to integrate. Yeah. So to take people who were already in the land and bring them in to, you know, to our culture, that seems completely anathema, especially in, as I say, in an age when we can't even do it with you know, we even think it's sort of, I don't know, internal colonialism to do that with newcomers today, because I guess the only acceptable thing for us to do in this day and age is not even to not to impose our culture on immigrants or non-whites, other groups, but even not even to believe that we have a culture in the first place to inculcate.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
and that insane. And that was a big issue with me, like I mentioned earlier, about back in the 80s, back when I was, you know, a teenager, what have you. My disaffection about this land, you know, about this country, a feeling of alienation, a feeling of what are we? And this is actually something that's even brought up in school, because I was involved as a teacher for many years before recent change in my career situation, and that's even in the curriculum, where the students are asked, what is a Canadian? And they all, and it's kind of like I don't know, are we this donut shop Tim Hortons? I don't know if you ever heard of them, probably not, but they're pretty big here, started by an ice hockey player, you know, from the NHL. Oh, okay, that's what we are.
This is the trouble when you start trying to characterize a culture, you end up
picking up on these
individual artifacts. It's silly things.
Like Britain, ice hockey and a donut shop.
and with Britain, it's like, we like tea and biscuits, you know.
It's superficial. It's just silly. And then the other thing that often Canadians would say in response to that question of what is a Canadian is, we're not American. Awesome. That's a great definition. That's a great identity. We're not American. So are the rest of the world. What? I mean, that means nothing. But that's Felix actually mentioned that earlier, that kind of this self-loathing, you know, inferiority complex, but at the same time, a superiority complex. So we go, you know, Canadians go around, at least we're not like the Americans. Yeah, we don't shoot everybody. Yeah, we're not mean and nasty. We're not this. We're not that. You know, all over, totally over exaggerated, views of Americans.
I can remember when Michael Moore did, was it Bowling for Columbine?
Oh, right, yeah.
And he had this segment. I'm remembering, like, this is from memory, so forgive me if I distort things. But he had this segment where he compared an American city with the Canadians had just over the border in terms of gun crime. And he said that, the Canadians are so much more peaceful. They just don't have all these homicides and all this. And of course he neglected to mention the demographics.
Yes. That is a huge thing. And it's something, and even liberal leftists up here, they just don't get it. Oh, well, it was because of our gun, control laws, whatever. It's like, no. Because if you actually take out one particular segment of the American demographic and then look at the gun crime rates, it's pretty much dead even with Canada. So, you know, maybe there's something to do with the demographics, because Canada doesn't have many blacks. It's growing, especially since the whole migrant crisis of 2015. Everybody and their dog, it didn't matter if they even came from places like Syria, you know, it's the same as what you have, but at not quite the scale that you've had over in Europe, you know, Britain and Europe. But that, you know, oh, it wasn't just the Syrians, but we got to bring the Iraqis and, you know, everybody else and people from Africa. And so we're starting to see that. Where I live is one of the whitest cities in North America. It used to be called, it was called Honky Town a number of years ago because it was the whitest city to have at least 250,000 people in North America. It was so white, like 97% white or something like that. That's changing, though, gradually, bit by bit. And I'm starting to see black people. It used to be the only blacks you saw were some Jamaicans who were actually pretty cool guys. They were okay. They didn't cause trouble. But now it's changing. And that demographic change may result in something that has happened in the United States eventually. I don't know. But that is a key difference between Canada and the U.S. Because as nations, they were actually once rated a few years ago as the two most similar nations in the world. And, you know, which you kind of go, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But that's a big difference right there, is the black factor.
Oh, absolutely. It clearly does. Like, yeah, you can't have 13% of your population be black without having very huge, serious effects on the general culture.
In so many things. Whereas in Canada, now it might have, we haven't had a census in a few years, so it might be a little higher now, but if you look it up, it's 3% black. And most of them tend to live in places like Toronto. It's the usual thing. They all glom to the big cities. And hey, where, what's, you know, Toronto's had a lot of problems with violent crime in recent years. Who's doing that? It used to be, oh, it's the Muslims. But then they started drilling a little deeper and went, actually, it's not so much the Muslims, it's the blacks, which is similar to what happened with London in the UK, where they used to say the same thing. Oh, it's the Muslim causes all the problems. And then they looked a little closer and went, it doesn't matter if they're Muslim, Christian, or atheist. There's one common denominator. They're all black.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I should say that, you know, that it does cut across these ethnic lines and racial lines as well. I mean, it's, you know, it's not just the blacks who cause.
Oh, no, it isn't, but disproportionately to. You know, when you rank them all, blacks always come on top in terms of committing the most crimes. It's the same with the United States, the whole 13, you know, that meme, the 13%, despite 13%, they commit, you know, it used to be 55, 56. I think the most recent is now 60%. 60% of the crime by 13%. And it's really not 13% because it's almost all males and it's usually young males. So when you really narrow it down, it's more like 4%. Commit roughly 60% of all the crime in the United States. But who gets most of the blame for crime? It's the white guys.
Of course. Well, let's get to the matter that we were going to discuss in depth, which was the trucker convoy in Ottawa. Well, it was across the country.
It was across the country.
It ended up, sort of the epicenter was Ottawa. But the background to this is that Canada was one of the most enthusiastic countries about COVID restrictions. And Justin Trudeau at the helm of that was obsessed with keeping Canadians safe. And he also did say there was a clip of him talking about China, how he sort of envied the ability of a dictatorship or a communist state to just implement policy, to just enforce things. Which, of course, does seem a bit ominous, but at the same time, you can understand a politician saying that in a sort of detached way. But in the case of Justin Trudeau, it really makes sense because he clearly is not afraid of using authority at all. And especially when he had the backing of the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, the UN, Bill Gates, God knows who else.
So Biden, too. Biden administration, that's come out recently, too.
Indeed. So do you want to take it away on the matter of Canada and COVID, getting towards the vax pass and all that, and then we'll get to the trucker convoy?
Yeah, I mean, Canada was up there amongst the most insane places, for sure. I mean, it varied a bit, because much like the United States, we're a federal political system. So, you know, you have the national government, but then you have the provinces, and each province technically carried the most weight. The provincial government carried the most weight as far as medical decisions, health-related decisions are concerned. So it's a bit complicated because you could have some places in Canada that were much more rigid than others, much like the U.S. Now, there was less freedom even in the freer provinces here than there were in the freer provinces in the U.S. States, I should say, in the U.S. But there was some variance because of that. It wasn't uniform, and Trudeau could not dictate things across the board. But he could dictate things like crossing the border, allowing you to travel on a plane, you know, on a train, on you know, ships. So anybody, you know, well, that's more the vaccinated state. That wasn't just the COVID thing, but early on, even it was pretty basically everyone. That eventually was just those people that couldn't go on any of them, couldn't cross the border and all that kind of stuff, and allowing people in. But the criticism, of course, was he was still allowing people in. In fact, the entire COVID period, for all the talk of we got to be strict about keeping people out, you know, because of COVID, they were still letting loads of people in. I mean, and now we're at a level of immigration that is unprecedented in Canadian history. I mean, we're allowing, this is just regular legal immigrants. It's about 400,000 or 400,000 a year. Now, keep that in mind, relative to the American population that's 10 times larger, that's equivalent to 4 million people going into the U.S. each year. U.S. right now brings in about 1 million a year. So it's massive in that respect. And that's not including the illegals that we're getting coming up from the south. We have our own southern illegal immigrants coming up, and those who come on various visas and who just never seem to go home after that. You know, they go on a student visa and never go home. So we had that issue going on, along with them berating us for this and that and restricting us, whether it's the federal government through Trudeau or provincial governments, berating people for daring to see their grandmothers, you know, daring to get together for any sort of celebration, even though they're completely healthy and not at all sick. And they're able-bodied and no risk, but it didn't matter. You know, it's the same kind of nonsense that you would hear over in the UK, in Australia, what have you. And you would have people, there was a fellow in Ontario who, was it, he didn't put his mask on and the police ended up shooting him dead. So in order to make sure for this, his safety and the broader safety of the community, he was killed. I mean, what the heck is that? You know, so you had insane stories like that. Again, I think Australia probably won in the insane story kind of sweepstakes, but Canada was definitely up there. And then it kind of eased and has eased more. They finally have pulled back about a lot of things. We still, anyone who is not vaccinated still can't go in the United States unless they sneak across, which a lot of people do. And that's more the Biden administration, though. If that's not Canada, Canada's has lifted.
Oh yeah, well, this was a thing that during the COVID. I mean, it was astonishing, really, how bad. I would say that, looking at it from an outsider perspective, I think that Australia was probably worse, especially the state of Victoria.
Yeah,
but
again, it depends because they're federal. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, but Canada was. Definitely. I mean, it sounded like a dystopia. It sounded hellish.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, the restrictions on freedom and just ordinary life that the Canadians were enduring for those, up until quite recently, actually. I mean, when I guess the it was only about June or July this year when the vaccine mandate was scrapped for flights, wasn't it?
Yeah, at flights, trains, all that. We finally were granted, he deigned to give us back our rights. How generous of him to us. And yes, I will openly say I was not vaccinated. And the majority of Canadians were, although the numbers have probably been skewed upwards. You know, I think that's the case in a lot of countries, that they're inflated. But, but I'm still not allowed to, and he also allowed people to work for the federal government again, because that was also a thing. If you want to remain, be a civil servant in the federal government, you had to be vaccinated. If you weren't, you were fired. And you couldn't apply for a job. Well, you could apply, but you wouldn't be ever hired because you were restricted because of the most important vaccination the world has ever known. But there still are restrictions, again, provincial level. Provincially, I cannot work for the provincial government because they still required to have the stupid vaccination. We also had like restrictions on going to restaurants and so forth. Again, that was provincial. So it really did vary. Again, some things were Trudeau, but sometimes he got blamed for things that weren't him. They were the provincial government that was slapping them, although he'd probably be happy to put those on too. But this leads in many ways, all this stuff leads in many ways to the trucker thing. Because what happened with the trucker issue is they said the truckers had to be vaccinated. And these are truckers, you know, the 18-wheel trucks. They're, you know, carting all that cargo back and forth between the U.S. and Canada. And there's a lot. I mean, there's a massive amount going between the two countries. That they had to be vaccinated or else they couldn't cross the border. Well, some of the truckers said, no, I'm not going to get it. And, well, I guess you're out of job, you know. But a lot of the truckers, a high percentage of them, were on their side. You know, sure, they got the vaccine, but they're like, but this is stupid. This is ridiculous. Why? Why are we doing this? We've never done this before. And so there was pushback, you know, and so he was getting pressure from, you know, sort of the common folk, the truckers, but even average people. And it swelled, the number swelled. Now, a lot of this happened, like I say, it wasn't, like you said, I should say, in Ottawa was the kind of the focal point of it. That's really far away from me. I live on the West Coast. You can, again, keeping in mind the size of the country, you got to take a plane to get there. And it's, what, 5-6 hour flight by a jet plane. So it's not like it's just, you know, down the road from me. But it did still resonate. And, of course, the mainstream media made sure to be on the side of the government. Even the so-called, you know, ostensibly right-wing media.
Well, I mean, it's easy to forget because it's like, what, 10, 11 months ago now?
Yeah, it's coming up.
It was something that happened at the start of the year. But so it's easy to forget that it was a huge thing at the time.
It was. It was
censored in the news in Britain. Yes. They just didn't talk about it. This is a policy that they must have come up with at some point.
Oh,
that if there's something we don't want to, that embarrasses us or that's inconvenient, we will simply ignore it. There's no need. We don't need to refute it or answer it or whatever, or even mock it. We can just ignore it and pretend it's not happening at all. And that was the case with the Dutch tractor protests later in the year. But it was definitely the case with the Canadian trucker convoy for quite a long time, quite a few days or maybe even weeks. Yeah. It was going on. It was building up. And mainstream media in Britain, at least, I'm sure like the general public just had no idea that this was happening.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's what's been going on. I mean, it's this kind of, you know, you could say it's a conspiracy, but I don't even know. It's not even necessarily that, you know, they all got together on Zoom or whatever. I think it's just that they're all of similar mindset and it didn't take much for them to all come to the same conclusion. We have to suppress this. You know, I don't know. I'm just guessing here, obviously. But definitely that was what was going on for the longest time. And it really blindsided everybody, blindsided people here in Canada. I don't think anyone in their wildest imaginations thought this would happen. I mean, certainly, I mean, when I started hearing people like yourself and others, you know, was talking about what's going on in Canada, you know, it's like, you're all like dumbfounded. It's like, what? Canada? Really? You know?
Well, indeed. Well, that's a good question. Maybe you could address that. Why did this happen in Canada? Why did this happen in America? Why did it happen in Britain, et cetera? What was your perception there?
Yeah, it is an amazing thing. And I'm not 100% sure. A lot of it is like, I'm still kind of coming to terms with how bizarre it is. It's such a strange mix. Like, it wasn't even strictly a right-wing thing. It wasn't even strictly a nationalist thing because a lot of the people were centrist, even moderately left of center that were involved, that supported it. Contrary to what has been presented by people like Trudeau in the mainstream media, who always make sure these are far-right bigots. And it's like most of them are kind of average, middle-of-the-road people politically, and just they're just average folk just who want to live their lives. That's all they are. And nationalist, well, in a broad sense, but not in a sense that we would maybe think of, more civic nationalist for sure. But it was bizarre too, because it brought together people that were, you know, prior to that, not necessarily allies, like the forging of alliances between the Anglos and the Francophones was really significant. So you'd see, you know, these video depictions of people with the fleur-de-lis on and another guy who would have Well, he might have the old red ensign flag, possibly, which is what Canada used to have. The old flag that has Union Jack on it. And they're coming together and shaking hands like, yes, we're going to do this together. We're going to resist, you know. And it was like, in that sense, this kind of upsurge of nationalism of we're going to fight back. And this terrified Trudeau. You could see it in his face in the early press conferences and what have you did, which he did in hiding. He was whisked away to some hidden chateaus. Well,
that's the whole thing in itself, that he ran away from Ottawa, even though he's got probably the best security in Canada.
Yeah, and he never met with them. He never met with the truckers. None of the higher-ups in the Canadian government ever met with them. All they did is cast aspersions, smeared them, called them names, but they refused to just sit down and have a chat and say, hey, what are your grievances here?
Presumably because that would be seen to legitimize the trucker convoy.
I guess, but they would more than happy to do with other protests in the past. This is things that have been brought up. There was a protest just before COVID, the whole COVID nonsense. I shouldn't say nonsense, but you know what I mean. COVID hit in early 2020. We were having massive protests with the native folk who didn't like a pipeline. And they were throwing fiery pallets onto the trains. They were physically attacking people and things. It was not just a calm little protest. And the government did basically nothing to them. Let them run, do what they please, because they're special because they're the native folk and have been persecuted so long by this evil white man. But then a year later, well, 2 years later, sorry, I guess it's closer to 2 years, you had this trucker protest, which was completely peaceful, but they smeared them again as if they were violent. They said that a guy that tried to run people over with his truck, I think it was his truck, was actually one of them. But in actual fact, he was a member of Antifa who was trying to run over the protesters in the city of Winnipeg, which is
more
Western. Yeah, still, even Trudeau even still talks about, oh, yes, you guys are violent, you know, trying to run people over. And it's like, the only ones trying to run anybody over were people sympathetic to you, your buddies in Antifa, you know, all your BLM types and all the rest of it. You know, they're the ones who were getting violent. They were the ones that were throwing rocks and spitting at people. At least literally all this kind of stuff was happening. You know, it wasn't the other side. The protesters were known for absolutely being totally peaceful, very pleasant, very hospitable. They were, like, even the homeless people in Ottawa said they have never eaten so well in all their lives, because the protesters would bring tons of food and they would have barbecues. And this is in, you know, February when it's frigid as can be. And they had hot tubs set up and all the rest of it. Like, it was a massive party, and they're handing out free food to everybody. And they were called all sorts of names. It was. I mean, I wasn't there, but all of what I heard and saw, but they were called nothing but bad names by Trudeau and by his
demonized.
Oh yeah, and perhaps worse is his henchman, the Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, who may soon be the Secretary General of the United Nations, by the way, because she's Ukrainian. She's of Ukrainian background, so she's beautiful. She's wonderful. Yeah, so she's a horrible human being, but yeah. So they were, and she's the one who froze the bank accounts too, by the way, and did it with, she smiled and laughed as people were squirming as they heard, my bank account's frozen. I won't be able to access any of my money. And she laughed at them. She laughed in a press conference. That's how evil she is. But, yeah. That's so anyways, incredible. Yeah, the whole thing was, it was like a dream, because I was trying to wrap my head around it too. You know, I was a fair distance away, sure, technically in the same country, but so far away. And yeah, you'd see the protests, even at the local level, they were all over, you know, like you were mentioning, they're in Toronto and Vancouver and, you know, all across the country in the middle of winter, you know, and most of the country is, you know, steeped, knee deep, I should say, in snow and freezing weather, except for the West Coast, as usual, because we're the mild part. We're the California of Canada. But, you know, so, you know, it was really crazy how it went. And it was so pleasant and party atmosphere like. And then you had this nasty character who was calling us names, who finally realized After being in hiding and clearly in fear, I am certain he was in fear of his life. I am certain that he and his government were sure that the truckers were going to string them up. it seemed like it in the early days.
But were they going to? I mean, I don't think that would ever
happen. No, I don't think they were. But he thought that was the perception. They were, because the whole thing was so unexpected. And it came, like you see the video of these big trucks barreling down the highway with everybody cheering them on, thousands upon thousands across the country, coming from all sides, it seemed like. And it was like it was like an armed force coming to take him, kind of thing, right? So he was terrified. He and his cronies were terrified. So in the early days,
at the time, I actually hold on a second. Let me see if I can find this. Yeah, I found this piece of music that actually Alex Jones had used in one of his early videos, one of his early films called Ottawa, and and it's a very sort of electronic piece, driving synth bass and all that. And I put it up and I said, as the trucks close in on Ottawa and doom approaches for the gay half-Cuban prancing prince, some music appropriate for his terror. I won't play it now because I don't want a copyright violation.
Yeah, yeah.
It was quite an amusing thing at the time. When was that? That was the 28th of January. So yeah,
okay.
Talking about a long time ago now.
Yes, because it was really swelling by the late January and carry on. It was, I guess, by the end of February that everything turned. Everything, it was like Trudeau and company realized, oh, we actually have the power. These people are just a bunch of normies who are partying. They think it's still the old rules that you can protest. It's not the old rules anymore. Exactly. We're going to destroy them.
Exactly. And this is the scary thing about it. I think that's absolutely right. The truckers thought, well, we live in the free world. We live in a democracy and all that. So all we have to do is make our complaints known or take our grievances to the powerful. It's kind of like the peasants in Russia taking their grievances to the Tsar.
Yeah.
Expecting that it's all fine, but well, at least they didn't live in a democracy, so it's not so surprising what happened next. But in Canada, it is supposedly a democracy, so you can understand why they thought, well, that's how it works, right? Surely,
yeah. Well, that's the Canadian way. We're very orderly. We're all about being reserved, and we're following the rules, and we're going to be kind, and we're going to listen to the other side, and we're going to follow the long established rule of order, law and order, and constitution, and blah 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 that have been going since time immemorial, that came handed down by the British and also the French a bit, but mostly the British, and you know, so. Of course you're going to let us say our piece. You know, we petition you, like you say, like the Tsar or the King or whatever, and the King will go, I've heard the cries of my people, and yes, I will contemplate this, and perhaps I will give way, you know. No, the King, Trudeau went, I'm going to kill you. Well, not really, metaphorically. Economically, I'm going to kill you.
I'm going to crush you at any rate. And that's...
Crush you. Yeah. I mean, it's hyperbole saying kill you, but it's because I was going with the whole King thing. But it's the same idea. Economically, to crush someone, though, is kind of killing them. It makes life extremely difficult. And there were still people, I think there still are people, from what I understand, who are still, their bank accounts are still frozen. They definitely were for months and months after. A lot of the leadership were thrown in prison, solitary confinement for extended time. I mentioned to you on Telegram, the fellow Jeremy McKenzie, he's this one guy, he was more or less a leader. He was more an agitator. He's an ex-military guy who, he was basically, it's kind of a party atmosphere on his live streams. I watched the odd one and so forth. He's mostly just goofing off, but he dares to criticize the Canadian government, and he had this joke about Diaghilom, creating a new nation of Diaghilom, which is the more conservative parts of Canada and the U.S. breaking away from the two countries and forming a new country right down the middle. It was a joke, but the Canadian government freaked out and thought it was real, and they started talking about him in Parliament and saying this is a serious insurrection. It's January 6th. This became Canada's January 6th narrative. These are insurrections.
Yes.
We need to get it.
Yeah, indeed, insurrectionists. And
so they started throwing people in prison like him.
Yeah, and confiscated the trucks.
Closed
bank accounts and all the rest of it.
It went not the same scale, obviously, as January 6th, but very similar in tone. Because they were terrified because of the January 6th incident. They were like, oh, it's the same thing up here in Canada.
Yeah.
All the
Yeah, it's not the same scale, but the same tone of absolutism. And this is the thing, and this is the point that I made at the time. When we talk about the incompetent Western states, that they can't get anything done, and there probably is a degree of incompetence there. Sort of flabby bureaucracies tend to be like that, inefficient or whatever. But when the state wants to get something done, it absolutely can get it done. It absolutely can. It very efficiently, very effectively, and with an absolutism that is quite terrifying, because it leaves the ordinary person completely helpless. I mean, when the police do something to you, what are you going to do? Are you going to complain? Are you going to take them to court? You can take the government to court. You can take the Google Corporation to court, or et cetera. I mean, this is massive stuff that ordinary people are now up against. And the rule of law, the procedures, the protocols, the checks and balances that used to provide protection and a balance between the everyday person and these huge, powerful entities, those processes have all just withered away at this point. That's quite clear now.
Absolutely. In Canada, far more than the United States. In the United States, you still had court cases where you would have victories, where there would be pushback and someone who was fired, a bunch of nurses fired in New York, one of the more liberal states in the U.S. Court case went on the side of all these nurses, like, or medical professionals, whatever, that lost their jobs. They all got their jobs back and got compensated and all the rest of it. That doesn't happen up here so much. It's pretty much the courts are almost all on the side of the government. Doesn't matter if you reference the Constitution or our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. That's meaningless. The courts have said, basically, because, and this is what really blew a lot of people's mind, because the federal government stopped doing particular things like suppressing people, putting in restrictions, whatever, because they stopped doing it, therefore, the court case is moot. It's moot now. Because, see, they're not doing it anymore, so there's no need to talk about this. It's the end of it. But, of course, that means any time the government in the future suppresses people or represses, whatever, restricts, and then pulls back just in time before the court case comes before the judge can say, see, it's moot because they stopped. It's like someone is beating you with a baseball bat, but they stopped. So it's not assault anymore. It's not grievous bodily harm because they stopped. It's moot now. Case dismissed. Have a nice day. And then you have nothing. You have nothing. You don't have the courts. You don't have parliament here. You don't have anybody. Nobody's on your side. And it doesn't matter about political parties, because even the so-called conservatives tend to be quiet about it, or they side.
With anything that matters, with any issue that actually matters, I wouldn't trust an ordinary politician, because they basically know nothing. They're not going to go against their party. They're not going to go against the government, the civil service, all the lobby groups, the NGOs, the hedge funds. Some fucking politician, like, they know nothing. Like, your average politician is just a jumped up councillor, basically. And I don't even say that with contempt. I just think it's the realistic picture. They don't know much. They don't want to know much. And they don't they have almost no actual power.
No, they don't. But it really was even that much scarier that the courts were just as bad. We thought, okay, yeah, we know. Politicians, a bunch of idiots, whatever. Doesn't matter who they are. They're all the same kind of thing. But you thought, okay, but at least you're going to follow the law, right? You're going to follow the Constitution and all that, the basic rights and freedoms. Nope. So we don't have anything. We don't have rule of law. We don't really have any rights and freedoms in Canada. I mean, technically they'll say it. It's on paper. But paper, written words on paper are meaningless if there's nothing behind it. If there's nobody who's going to enforce it, who's nobody who's going to say, you're right, so-and-so shouldn't be allowed to do that. But we don't have that, because now it's the women fantasy. It's pure caprice by way of the government. They can do whatever they want. And we just have to hope that the particular person now will, you know, give us some freedom, will actually hold someone accountable. We can't be certain of it anymore. We used to think we could be, but it's just like I said, with the whole, you know, whole thing with the trucker protests and everything. They were so normie about it. You know, they, these people, there's very few of them that would be anything close to what we are politically.
Yeah, well,
They thought, they really sincerely thought the old rules applied, and they weren't paying attention. They weren't realizing things have been shifting for years, and Trudeau and his cronies, and I don't think he's the brains by any mean behind it, but the people behind him, they knew, and they realized once the truckers weren't actually going to use force against them, it's all over.
Yeah.
They were in control again.
Yeah. And obviously we don't want to advocate anything in particular.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying.
No, I know. I just, before I go into this bit, but I want to quote Cantbot when he was talking about January the 6th. Mm-hmm. And he said the following, and this applies, I think, equally to the truckers in Canada a year later. He said, imagine storming the capital of the United States and then just wandering around the building confused about why the level isn't ending.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. And I think the truckers had the same idea. They thought, well, we've just got to get to Ottawa and then the level will end, because that's it. That's the goal. And the flagpole and, you know, all that. And then maybe we'll get to a bonus stage, or, you know, if we've done really well, kind of thing. But it really isn't like that. You can get into the capital, wander around, and nothing happens. And then the shit comes down on you.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same with Ottawa. Like, well, okay, you can go to Ottawa. You can organize this thing. But if you're not prepared to actually assert yourselves over the powerful, then the powerful will assert themselves over you. And that, I think, is what, I mean, it makes sense. You know, that there was somebody in the live chat a few minutes ago said that this, I've lost it now, but he said something about that this being a white European notion, that the rule of law and that the powerful should listen to the everyday people and all that. He said it's a cross that white Europeans have to bear, because we have this idea that, because our societies did used to work like that.
Yes.
At least far more than they do now. And that's a profound difference, I think, that's taken place in our societies over the last, however long you would say, but definitely in recent times it's manifest.
Yeah,
The truckers discovered that to their cost. I mean, the thing is, I think that they actually could have, again, I'm not advocating this, but I think they actually could have got what they wanted.
Oh, yeah.
But they weren't prepared to do what was necessary to do that. And they had no idea what was necessary. They thought, just get to Ottawa and that's it.
They're just petitioning the ruler. He can see us, can't he? We're really, you know, we're upset here. Can't he see us? Our truckers just want to make a living. They just want to cross the border. Yeah. Can't you just be reasonable? That's what they thought it was going to be. And he thought, they're coming to get me. And then they didn't.
Yes, and so, that's what I mean.
He was like,
this is the point that I was going to make, is that I think he had good reason. Well, from his point of view, he had good reason to be scared, because they could have done it. You know, they could have deposed him. And again, obviously, that would be a terrible thing to happen. But I'm just saying that it was within their physical capabilities. Sure. It was within their capabilities to do that. So I think, he knew that. But they didn't think that it would even come to that. I don't think they had any intention to be violent or to insurrection.
No.
I think that was the furthest thing from their minds. I think they had a very naive notion of, well,
extremely
protest.
Extremely naive. And it did get dark even earlier on. They had the whole incident, I don't know if you heard about it, in Alberta, and this, which is the second most western of the provinces, where they had a big protest at its border. And they had a situation where they found a cache of guns relatively in a house, I believe it was, relatively close to where the protesters were. Well, the police started, you know, ruminating about, well, it seems to be kind of close to the protesters. So then it got lumped in with them, and it anteed up the whole thing of violence and so forth. And the protesters are like, what? No, we're just at the border here. We're doing a bit of a blockade, sure, but it's a peaceful protest. But then all of a sudden, oh, you got a cache of guns over there. And it's like, it was like up the road, like I think a mile away or something like that. No connection. The police eventually admitted they had absolutely no connection at all, no evidence of a connection. In fact, it's since come out that they're pretty much positive it was planted there, probably by the RCMP. Again, shades of January 6th, where you got like the CIA or FBI or whatever doing their nonsense. Up here, it's the RCMP and CSIS, which is our equivalent to the CIA. They do stuff that are up to a lot of shenanigans, you know, so, which is why a lot of people here, you know, it used to be the RCMP was so highly trusted. They're not so much anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, it's depressing to hear that it was the RCMP or it might have well been them, because the RCMP, indeed, even abroad, has a reputation for wholesomeness and kind of like, again, to mention Twin Peaks again, I don't know why that's come up twice in one stream, but anyway, the FBI in Twin Peaks, that's 1989, 1990.
Yes.
At that point, the FBI still had this reputation for probity, wholesomeness, you know, not duty, service to the nation and all that.
Yeah.
And the RCMP, definitely the same sort of thing, even more so, actually.
Oh,
it
yeah.
The coziness about it, you know. And to hear that even that has been corrupted, I mean, my God, you know, it's depressing to think of the organs, the societies, the things that people used to inspire love and affection in people, all of it has been corrupted.
Oh, it has. I mean, with the RCMP, they basically stopped being rank and file police officers working their way up to the top to just these professionals who tend to come straight out of university, and they end up being the top dog running things. And they were corrupt as can be, because they were just, it was just managerialism to, you know, the max, and making sure that they were building their little empires within the system. And all that. You know, there's a lot of negative things you end up hearing about where it's like they were totally detached from what was going on with the grassroots police officers, who weren't necessarily corrupt. Some of them were, of course, too. But it's a complicated thing, but it definitely is such a shift from the past where it was, you know, they always got their man, and the story of the, you know, RCMP going through the long territory, again, I think it's British Columbia and up into the Yukon to get the Mad Trapper. I don't know if you ever heard that story, but that was one of the things that was kind of one of those early stories of the amazing bravery of the RCMP. They originally called the Northwest Police, but then they became the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. You know, of this, was it Sam Steele or something? I think was his name, who went, you know, on his own after this Mad Trapper who had murdered people and stuff like that. You know, it's like, yes, he's one of us. He's there to stand for us. Now we go, he's the guy who's going to put guns in your house and make it seem like you're a criminal. You know?
God.
That's how it's gone. But it's the same thing, you know, FBI and all that stuff. So anyways, the whole protest thing, it looked very positive for the longest time. It was surreal. It was like, is this ever going to end? What's going to happen? Is Trudeau actually going to bend and finally meet with these people? That was the thing that kept being brought up, not by the mainstream media again. The mainstream media very rarely gave any positive reports about the trappers, even the so-called, you know, the ostensibly conservative media.
I think you meant the truckers, not the trappers.
Did I say trappers? Well, the trappers too. Yeah. But no, the truckers. Yeah, I meant to say the truckers. Yes. And that Trudeau would just never meet. Nobody. Trudeau wouldn't meet him. His deputy wouldn't meet him. Nobody. All they did is badmouth them. And then all of a sudden it just got really dark, you know, it with the whole freezing of accounts and everything. And it's just like, what happened? Why has this gone this bad? You know, how are we like this? And the sad thing is how many in Canada thought it was great. Shut them down. Freeze their accounts, throw the whole lot in prison, throw away the key. They didn't care. And they had such a distorted view of what these people were like that they were actually these horrible people. But most of it was, like I mentioned earlier, with the whole fake story, you know, the misreported story about the guy trying to run people over. It's because they got false reports fed to them by the mainstream media. So their, you know, their understanding of these people were they were violent, that they stole from the poor. That was another narrative that was going around. They were stealing food from the poor, from the homeless. When actually the homeless were admitting we're the best fed we've ever been in our lives. We're getting kind of fat here, actually, because we're eating so much food, you know, and crime dropped. The story was crime went up. No, they actually chased away all the creepers and the, you know, violent guys and stuff anytime, because all the guys would basically set up their own kind of a policing system. So any kind of guys you might want to, you know, rape a woman or steal from people, these guys would chase them away, you know. So the crime rate, they admitted the crime rate dropped to basically zero. So, yeah, but this story was presented differently. Sorry?
It amazes me because you only have to look at footage off the, you know, Ottawa, the sort of settlement that they set up, if you want to, the camps and all that, to see what kind of people it was. And there, it's absolutely not people who are going to be committing petty crime or violent crime or sex crime, whatever. It's absolutely ridiculous. These are very moral, upstanding, working class people, and a few middle class as well, I guess. But either way, the point is they're not criminals. I mean, it's obvious. No. You can see it all over the footage.
Yeah. Well, and the way they also tried to present, if you, of course, you know, dismissed all the ridiculous allegations, is that, well, but they did, you know, park their trucks in the middle of the street. So, I mean, they blocked the way, and also they blocked the border, so people couldn't get, you know, the trucks couldn't come across that wanted to come across. So they're you know, obstructing things and causing economic problems. And it's like, okay.
You know, after a year of lockdown,
yes.
You know, Crimea River,
yes. Honestly. Now we are concerned about economic issues. Now, after a year of the government shutting everything down, like you said, suddenly now is a problem when for a short time, some truckers shut some things down in some parts of the border. It wasn't even the whole border. Unlike the Canadian government, and the Ottawa thing was like, oh, at most you could call that the kind of thing you'd get a ticket for, like a parking violation or something like that. It's such a minor thing. It's not a crime. But they always made sure to park in such a way that people that were driving could still get between the vehicles. They could get between the trucks. And they always made sure to clean the streets too. That was another thing. They littered everywhere. No. Lowest level of litter they've ever had, basically, in Ottawa, and they cleared all the snow and ice off the roads all the time. But all of this was presented the exact opposite of what was really going on. And then they're painted in such a way as the evil villain, and the media would run with that.
Which in turn indicts another sector of society, which is the media.
Oh, absolutely.
We've talked about the RCMP, the government. But the media as well was as guilty as anyone here, because
yes.
They completely sustained the establishment line including vilifying these good people.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I have to really restrain myself in terms of the anger that I quite often have about a number of things, and that's one of them. I really, really, really hate the mainstream media.
You and me both.
It is worldwide. It is.
Oh yeah.
But there are different levels of it depending on the circumstances.
I think that journalists are the worst. I mean, people moan about lawyers, but you know, I think journalists are even worse than lawyers.
Oh, it's not much even worse. Close. It's not even close. I used to think it was. I used to think, oh yeah, you'd make all the jokes about lawyers, you know.
At least some lawyers do some good.
Yeah, you could get some lawyers to advocate for you.
Yeah. Journalists are just scum. Universally. Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if there are any good journalists in existence anymore. And most of them seem to be hell-bent on lying. One of a less simplistic way to say it. They seem to have no... And it's the exact opposite of what they should be doing and ostensibly are, like what they purport to be doing. We're just presenting a fictitious version of things to the public every single day in, day out.
It's really amazing how much it's gone that way, how much in lockstep they are compared to even 10 years ago. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. It's like they're in concert in so many ways, worldwide. I mean, it's just crazy. It really does show you. I mean, there's no independent journalism in that sense. Yeah, there's the alternative media, mostly right-wing, although you get some kind of left-leaning guys like, what's his name, Glenn Greenwald and so forth, who's, you know, I'm going to give him credit. He quite often will dig up things, and he attacks people on the left, and he's from the left. You know, I wouldn't agree with him probably on most worldview issues, but the guy... at least has been fairly decent about things. But for the most part, especially the mainstream media, no way, not a chance. They're awful. They're just horrible. And, you know, and they're not even terribly bright, a lot of them.
No, definitely not. It's definitely not. I think this is one of those professions that has become doable by a dimwit. Whereas I think 50 years ago, you probably did need to be fairly well educated and intelligent to do the job.
Yes.
But now it's just literally, you know, some idiot from a women's studies degree or something can just parrot the lines. And that seems to be all that the job now requires.
Absolutely.
One of the commenters says, Padfa says, lawyers are mercenaries, but they're honest about that. Journalists are just liars for the sake of it. And that's a good summary.
Absolutely.
Let's wrap this one up then. Are there any sort of closing thoughts about the trucker protest and Canada and the COVID era, all of that, the things that you'd like to see?
I mean, the trucker thing's more or less done. Sure, there was still protests even relatively recently at a lower degree. It was still simmering. There's still a lot of hostility. You still get things like, you'll see, especially like comments online and so forth. A lot of Fed posting, normies Fed posting, like to a level that those of us who are more of our particular political distinction would be telling them, you gotta rein it in, guys.
Yeah, they were.
They were literally were saying, get me rope now.
Yeah.
You know,
it was a similar thing with January the 6th. You've got the cliche meme of the boomer who's intense.
Yeah,
and there was a meme of a boomer father telling his son 10 years ago, you know, be careful what things you say online and what you post online. And then today he's telling his son, I'm going to storm the Capitol and take down the US government. You know, there was a thing about the normie becoming intensely, if not red-pilled perhaps on certain issues, but definitely very pissed off. Would you say a lingering effect of the trucker convoy?
Oh, it's absolutely, and it's still going. There's still, the resentment level is still there. It's still bubbling under the surface. Even before the trucker thing, there was things going on. I mean, there had instance in the last election, which was, my concept of time has been distorted because of the whole COVID thing. But I guess that was in 2020? Federal election, the last federal election. We've had so many federal elections because we keep having, since we have a parliamentary system similar to what you have over there, you know, if someone does not get the majority of seats, you know, they have to kind of cobble together something with a smaller party to keep in power, right? That's what Trudeau's been doing for years. It was last year. Oh, man. Yeah. Again, time has been distorted for me. But he was literally, Trudeau was literally getting pelted by people. Like, they were not just screaming obscenities at him, like so vitriolic. They were literally throwing rocks at him. He had to run for his life pretty much because that's how much anger there was directed towards him. They were coming for him. They were gunning for him to a level that I've never seen anything like that in Canada. Like, usually it's like, oh, you have little pleasant protests. And most of the protests, if they get a little hot under the collar, it was usually by people on the left against someone who is more conservative. Oh, you know, you're an evil misogynist, rapist, blah, blah, blah. You know, nonsense. A lot of it was nonsense. But it's the typical thing like you have over there, right? But this was a ostensibly progressive guy getting attacked. And I don't even think they were necessarily all right-wing people. I think they were just people that just hated him. They didn't care if they were left, right, center. They hated him so much and his government. But he was the face of it. And they were literally pelting him. He would come off a tour bus, whatever, and he'd get pelted by a bunch of rocks, by stones, you know, what have you. It's bizarre. So... that hostility is still there. There's still a lot of it simmering, like I said, online and what have you. You know, there's a lot of hatred towards him. Yes, there are pockets where he would still get voted in. You know, anybody who calls himself part of the Liberal Party of Canada would get voted in no matter what, such as Toronto. Toronto is a bastion of progressivism. Vancouver, to a great extent, much of it. Montreal and so forth. Like is mentioned, all the big cities basically are overwhelmingly progressive and generally pretty multicultural. you know, it's more the smaller cities and towns, the hinterlands. Those ones are the old Canada, you know, overwhelmingly. And they tend to lean more to the right. They're more likely to be nationalistic. But the problem is it doesn't matter because the big cities will vote and they win, you know.
Yes, that's the whole problem, isn't it? And you see that same problem playing out in Sweden.
It's everywhere.
In Germany, everywhere. It's the pause.
U.S.
Big cities that mess everything up, unfortunately. Well, okay, let's leave that one here. I think this has been a really enjoyable one, and it's I wasn't sure with the format being shaken up there, but I think we weathered it very well. And it was a nice cameo from Felix. But other than that, it was I think a very interesting discussion that we've had. So thank you for this.
No, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, I'll be back in about 20 minutes, 25 minutes with Dave Martell of the Bizarchives. In the meantime, this was The Course of Empire. So thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Thanks again. Bye.
Okay, and I will see you all quite soon. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.